and certain amounts of the isotopes, and the other one has a small amount of rubidium and certain amounts of the isotopes. Notice that I drew the amounts of the different isotopes in constant proportion. And the reason for that is that although these molecules have different molecular weights, and therefore we give them different atomic weights, and therefore we give them different numbers, they're chemically indistinguishable. And whenever a rock is formed today, or at any time in the past, as far as we can tell in the Earth's crust, there simply is no way to separate these things out, so we get these in constant proportions. In fact, we haven't been able to separate them adequately in the lab until the last couple of decades. Okay, what would happen in a rock to one of these minerals if it was then formed and then allowed to decay? Next slide. What happens is that rubidium begins to decay at a known rate, and it forms strontium-87. Now, the nice thing about the system is it only forms 87. And what happens through time, as shown in the top part of the slide, is that we get an increase in 87, which is proportional to the age of the rock. And in the bottom part of the slide, if the same thing went on for a longer time, say 3 or 4 billion years, the increase would be much greater. And what we can do is to use this method as a chronometer to measure how long it's been since the rock was made. Now, let me show you how this works. If we take a rock, and we pick it up and we want to learn its age, the first thing we can do, next slide, is to separate the rock into its constituent minerals. Geologists are real good at doing this, that's what they make their living at, and then we measure the amounts of the various isotopes in each of the minerals of the rock, and that's important, we measure them in each. And what you would get is a very, very nice picture. Here I've diagrammed three minerals, one of which is low in rubidium at the top, the other one at the top and the bottom is low in strontium, and the one in the middle is sort of mediocre between the two. Note that we make no assumptions, I'll say it again, no assumptions about the amount of rubidium we start with or the amount of strontium. Now notice something really neat. In the one on the top that has low rubidium, if the system is cool, if everything is working right, we should get almost no change in the original strontium ratios. In the middle one, where there's a fair amount of rubidium, we should get a dramatic change in the strontium ratios, and we should see a certain amount of strontium-87 showing up. And in the one at the bottom, we should see a whole bunch of strontium-87, because there's almost no strontium in it to start with. Now, the system assumes nothing because it is self-checking. If this rock is not disturbed, if none of the distortions occur, which can happen all the time in geology, then you can make an accurate prediction. And the prediction is that the amount of strontium you build up should be proportional, in precise proportions in every mineral in the rock, to the amount of rubidium that starts out in that rock. And if it's not precise, if it's not proportional, the geologist said something funny's happened, I won't use it for a date and I'll throw it out. It's interesting. Next slide. Now, this is a graph, I apologize for this, but the graph shows the power of the method. On this graph, we graph a starting ratio of rubidium to strontium on the bottom, and the radiogenic isotope of strontium to the non-radiogenic on the side. Now, I gotta say, this is a little heavy, but here's what happens. When a mineral is formed, because the strontium-87 to 86 ratio is constant, and we always see that in nature because they're chemically indistinguishable, the line is flat. A flat line means a zero age. What should happen as it ages is that every single mineral in the rock should increase in its ratio to exact proportions to how much rubidium is in the system. And that means that one point at a time, those points should move up, but the rock, every mineral in the rock, has to stay consistent if the system is closed. It's an extremely delicate system because the slightest disturbance, the adding of a little bit of strontium or the leaching out of rubidium or a chemical change, will screw up the points. It will scatter them all over the chart, and we'll know right away if the system has a problem. Next slide. Here's some data. Here are some rocks that were taken from minerals in the Sun River, Montana Basin. And what you can see are separate determinations of a couple of different types of minerals. Now notice something. There are lots of points on those lines. Every single point is an independent determination of a different mineral from the same rock. The slope of the line is what gives us the age. The fact that the points lie on the straight line means that every single mineral in the rock says the same age. That's called a concordant rock. Concordant, singing together. A discordant rock, singing out of tune, is one where the points give different ages. Discordant rocks do not yield reliable dates. Geologists write papers about them saying, don't mess with this, it'll give you the wrong date. Dr. Morris can probably quote those papers to show you how unreliable the method is, but the fact of the matter is that geologists use concordant ratios to date rocks. Next slide. Here's another one. This illustrates the range of the system. On the left-hand side are some nice rocks, GN. And a gneiss is a mineral that's very, very old, in many cases can be very, very old. This particular one dates to 3.7 billion years by this method. On the right-hand side, younger rocks, because we can find younger rocks, and the method tells us that they're young, 460 million years. Next slide. Meteorites. Meteorites can be dated too, and they come out consistently, about 4.6 or 4.7 billion years. Look at that. Every single point, an independent determination from a different mineral. Extremely sensitive, self-checking. It shows us an error if it exists. Next slide. Same thing. This particular one is a siltstone from Western United States. It dates to 935 million years. And the next slide is a reminder of the method, that every point on the line comes from an independent determination, and we only use rocks that are concordant to date critical things in the fossil record and critical things in geology. Now there is one assumption in the method, and one assumption alone, and that is that the radioactive decay constant is constant with time. In other words, the rate of decay, the half-life of the mineral. Now that's an assumption, that's true. It's also true that the rate of radioactive decay is the most constant thing, the most constant process that has ever been measured in nature. Now Dr. Morris may get up here and he may say, we now know that the rates vary. That's true. And if he'll give you the reference, I'm sure he has it, you can look it up in the library, and what you'll discover is if these minerals are vaporized by heating them to 4,000 degrees Kelvin, and if they're put under 100 atmospheres of pressure, we get a variation in the decay rates of a little bit less than 1%. Now, it's perfectly all right to say that if the Earth was heated to 4,000 degrees Kelvin and the atmosphere was 30 or 40 times as strong as it is right now, everything would be vaporized and the rocks would give ratios that were incorrect by 1%. I admit that. The fact of the matter is that this system and the elegant nature of it and the fact that the isochrones can be made is big, big trouble for Dr. Morris. And the reason for that is the central premise of his theory is that the Earth is young. Now, there's two ways he'll deal with this. One is he's going to quote a lot of articles about errors in radiometric dating methods, and by implication, he'll say that this method stinks too. Friends, listen to the quotes very carefully, because he will not be able to produce a single quote, not one, that suggests that a concordant, it's one of these, isochron, that's what the line is, from a rock ever gives a date. Ever gives a date that can be shown to be too old. Not one. Now, he's really good in the library, and I know that if there was a quote out there, he'd find it. But the fact of the matter is he can't. Now, incidentally, there is a possible error in these, and that is if a rock is heated up during metamorphosis, the isochron can be reset to zero, and that means you can get a date that's too young. But there's no way that anyone has even suggested that you can get a date that's too old. Now, that's one strategy. The other strategy is he may retreat from science into the Almighty. I'll show you what that means. You see, when I tried to figure out how to explain to you radiometric dating, I wanted to have a nice authoritative quote to convince you, like from Julian Huxley or from Isaac Asimov and something. And guess what the Lord delivered into my hand? Next slide. Well, that's the same one. This nice book. Now, this doesn't have as nice a cover as the other one, but it's just as good a book. And in Genesis Flood, we can see something very interesting. Next slide. Here's a couple of quotes from Dr. Morris. There is even more commonly disagreement between uranium and thorium ages. Well, commonly, that's poetic license. As more and more evidence was gathered, the lead method began to carry conviction. There could be little doubt when pure thorium minerals associated in the same rocks with pure uranium minerals gave the same absolute age. There are now known even a few cases. There are so many, I couldn't even fit them in a full carousel. Where there is agreement between ages obtained by the lead method, the rubidium method, and or potassium method. Fine, Dr. Morris says, we've got conviction, these things really exist. Next slide. Now, this I like. We reply, however, to the old ages, that the biblical outline of Earth history with the geological framework provided thereby would lead us to postulate exactly this state of the radioactivity as evidence. We would expect radiogenic minerals to indicate very large ages and so forth and so on. Now, I like that because it has boldness and it has style. They simply come right out and say, why, we expected the ages to be very old. We expected 4.5 billion even though we know the Earth is 10,000. That's very nice after the fact, but I really would have appreciated if creationists in the 20s who were saying that the Earth was young had reminded us that if we were ever able to develop methods to date rocks, the ages would be 4.5 billion even though it's 10,000. It's a lot nicer to predict before than it is to predict after. And finally, the next slide. This is interesting. In the absence of specific revelation, it seems impossible to decide the question with finality. That means the age of the Earth. However, it is more satisfying and therefore more reasonable to infer that all these primeval clocks, meaning the radiogenic clocks, since they were wound up at the same time, were also set to read the same time. Whatever this setting was, we may call it the apparent age of the earth, but the true age of the earth can be known only by means of divine revelation. Dr. Morris says, so do you, that the true age of the earth may be known only by means of divine revelation. Now, revelation is a fine thing for dealing with matters spiritual. Some believe it is the source of ultimate spiritual truth, and I respect that point of view. I respect it absolutely. But Dr. Morris says simply that when the facts of science, not spiritual questions, but the fact of science go against his theory, well, to hell with science. Divine revelation is only the only way to answer a scientific question. There's one more thing, and this is a critical point. The radiometric methods today could prove the Earth was young, if it really was. All those isochrones would be straight lines. Henry Morris would be the professor of geology at Harvard. But ladies and gentlemen, how does special creation deal with evidence about the age of the Earth? And the answer is, it says the evidence doesn't matter. Okay, now another good part. Dr. Morris has made the statement that the second law of thermodynamics makes evolution impossible. I mean, how could we all be so stupid? I mean, all you'd need to do is to straighten out these evolution idiots would be to sit them down with a physical chemist, have a nice talk to them. The physical chemist could tell us about the second law, and this is all impossible. Now go out and do something else. What's the reason for that? What is the deal with the second law? Friends, Dr. Morris is fibbing, and I believe that Dr. Morris knows it. I will answer his question in two parts. Number one, let's assume that life already exists, and then see if the second law forbids further evolution, further increases in complexity. Okay, I'm going to do that first. Then secondly, let's see if the second law makes the evolution of a cell from non-living matter impossible. Next slide. Now, in my book, Dr. Morris has borne false witness against the second law of thermodynamics, so I thought I'd bring the second law in to speak for itself. This is the Gibbs equation. It is the most straightforward chemical demonstration of the second law we have, and I'm sorry to bring the math in. This is science. We've got to get in there. We've got to think about it. Okay. Delta G is a quantity known as Gibbs free energy. It tells us if a reaction goes spontaneously. If delta G is negative, whatever it is we're talking about will happen spontaneously. If it's positive, it generally won't happen. In fact, it'll run in the other direction. Okay, what determines that? Three other quantities. Delta H, which is the energy change associated with the reaction. We can make reactions go sometimes, which require energy by putting energy into them. T is simply the temperature of the system. Which way a reaction goes is influenced by temperature. And delta S is entropy. Delta S is the measure of disorder. Now, I don't want to get into the details of the mathematics, but there is a very straightforward prediction from the equation. And the prediction is simple. You can have an increase in order. And by the convention, that means a decrease in delta S, a decrease in entropy, if the reaction is such that energy is supplied in the system. If you supply energy, you can have an increase in order. That's straightforward. It's right out of the math. You can see it. You can work it out with your own slide rule calculator and pencil. It's a simple fact. Next slide. This is a popularized version of the second law to show you a little diagram in what can happen in a localized system. Now, it's absolutely true that the entropy of the universe must always decrease. The universe as a whole always becomes more disorderly. No evolutionist has a quarrel with that. It's absolutely true. The next slide shows us a little bit closer in. When we look at that individual system, what can a system do? It can increase in entropy, meaning it can get more orderly, it can stay the same, or it can get more disorderly. The fact of the matter is that increases in order are not only possible, they're predicted by the second law, as long as we have a sufficient supply of energy. This slide is from the standard textbook on bioenergetics by Albert K. Leninger of MIT. The fact is that all one needs to support an increase in complexity, which evolution demands, is energy. Next slide. And the method of trapping the sun's energy is, in fact, the basis of every single living thing on this planet. This is a chloroplast. This is the thing that makes green plant cells green. Now, I work on these things. This is my bag. And in the next slide, we see one of these in the electron microscope. There is a very, very marvelously complex system, I know Dr. Morris will like me saying that, which is capable of trapping the energy of sunlight, converting it to chemical energy, and making it usable for everything on Earth. This is the engine of life and the engine of evolution as well. With this, the enormous efficiency of the system, the fact is that there are no thermodynamic barriers to increases in complexity. The smokescreen about the second law is a farce. Now, Dr. Morris can gesture, he can talk about universal laws and so forth, but the fact is that evolution is not forbidden by the second law, it's consistent with it. Now I know that Dr. Morris, once he is caught in this particular deal about the second law, he has a predictable avenue of retreat. So I want to fire a missile down there before he gets down the corridor. He'll say, well, the chloroplast harvests energy from the sun. That's right, gets energy. But where did the pattern for the chloroplast come from? Where did that come from? That didn't just come about by itself, did it? Well, if he says that, that's fine, because he proves my point. He admits that the second law says nothing about evolution once living systems are here, and instead he has to fall back and saying, where did the first cells come from? So I'm going to score 1 point for evolution, and now we're going to see where the first cells came from. Okay. There's nothing in evolutionary theory, nothing, that says that living cells must have come from inanimate matter. It doesn't say that. In fact, there was once a famous creationist. His name was Charles Darwin. And at the end of a book called The Origin of Species, he wrote this. This is how he ended The Origin. There is grandeur in this view of life, and he meant evolution, with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or one. And that while this planet has gone on cycling, according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Now, Darwin couldn't conceive of any origin for that first cell except for a theological one. But we know a lot more about the chemistry of living things than we did in Darwin's time. So what can we say? Okay, number one, there isn't any historical evidence of whether or not the first cells evolved from non-living matter. There's no argument about there. Dr. Morris and I agree. But is there any evidence, however, that any step in chemical evolution is truly forbidden? And here's the key. Doesn't look like it. Every single step on the way to generating the complex molecules of life seems to happen spontaneously. Let me show you. Next slide. Now, the most famous experiment was done by somebody named Stanley Miller. He did it when he was in graduate school. Every graduate student would love to have thought of what Stanley Miller thought of, except they'd like to have thought of it first. Now, what he did was to place some very simple molecules in a flask, carbon dioxide, water, methane, and ammonia. He sealed them, he heated and cooled them, and away you went. What happens? Well, a series of complex molecules necessary to life is formed, and it's formed very quickly. Next slide. In fact, so many things are formed that the main problem that Miller had was that the flask gummed up with organic molecules so quickly that the spark generator turned off. It was unbelievable. Just about everything was formed, all sorts of amino acids and everything else. Now, Dr. Morris might tell you, we got a minute amount of product out of this experiment. Not so. Next slide. The kinetics of the formation were absolutely unbelievable. An enormous amount of amino acid was formed. The starting materials were used up rapidly. And again, the main problem was that the molecules which were formed, besides the one in the last slide, were so complicated that it was difficult to analyze. And we can analyze them better today, but Stanley had a rough time in 1950 because he didn't have the biochemical tools we do. Now, this experiment has been repeated in every conceivable way, and every single molecule, every one important to living things can be formed in this way. And one of the most remarkable examples is a base called adenine. The next slide. Adenine is probably the most important nucleotide base in living things because we have it in DNA and we've got to have it. We have it in RNA. Adenine is tacked onto messenger RNA molecules, and it's the source of a molecule known as ATP. Which is the basic energy currency of the cell. Now, how do you form adenine? The answer is, you don't need a PhD, you don't need a pattern, you don't need a blueprint. You take hydrogen cyanide, which forms, incidentally, immediately in the Miller apparatus. You take hydrogen cyanide and you shine ultraviolet light on it. In fact, adenine forms so quickly under this that there was a commercial process to make it before we realized how important it was biologically, and it was called hydrogen cyanide pentamer. It's the most natural thing in the world. Now, Dr. Morris can tell you that the second law forbids spontaneous increases in complexity, even if you put energy into the system. All this needs is energy in the system. Adenine is far more complex than hydrogen cyanide. It forms. Why? Because it's consistent with the second law, which says you can have an increase in complexity if energy is available for the system. You know what's remarkable? Adenine is the most important base in living things, and it is the first thing that forms, and it forms easily. Isn't that remarkable? Now, none of this proves that life evolved, but ask yourself this question. Please, all of you, regardless of your feelings, ask yourself this question. If molecules like this could never be formed spontaneously, how would Dr. Morris treat it? Are you kidding? He would begin his debates by talking about the great work of Stanley Miller that showed that the evolution of living things is impossible. But the answer comes out the other way. He's got to find a way to get around the problem. Now, I don't have to go out of time to go through every step of the many experiments that others have done. I'll generalize only by saying that the insurmountable barriers that Dr. Morris may suggest exist between living and non-living matter aren't there. Dr. Morris may have computers and calculations saying it's impossible, it couldn't occur, we ran it through the computer, it couldn't work. But there is one unifying characteristic to all the calculations, and that is that they all assume that a molecule or so must self-assemble. None of them suggested molecular self-replication could occur. And for that, and the reason for that, besides the fact that it would make evolution more probable and might give an answer that Dr. Morris doesn't like, is because it makes mathematics more complicated. The mathematicians who do these don't like that. Well, get ready for a surprise. Next slide. When you're certain, and Dr. Morris is certain, that life could never have occurred spontaneously, you don't bother to do experiments because you already know how they're going to come out. Well, progress never comes from certainty, it comes from doubt. Some scientists thought that maybe there might be a way that a molecule could exist in very simple conditions like that on the primitive Earth and turn out to be self-replicating in the absence of an enzyme. And what I direct you to is this month's issue of Scientific American, where an experiment done in Germany by Manfred Eigen and in California by his vigorous competitor Leslie Orgel has turned out a remarkable series of studies on non-enzymatic RNA replication. It turns out that RNA, one of the molecules important in heredity, is self-replicating. It can copy itself. It does a lousy job of it. It's a slow self-replicator. It makes a lot of mistakes, but it can copy very short sequences of oligonucleotide. It doesn't need a big implicated system, just itself. Now, it turns out that if you fool around with the system and you drop in, and they did this first by accident, a few small amounts of zinc ion, there's lots of zinc around in the Earth's crust, the fidelity of non-enzymatic RNA replication shoots right through the roof. And this is the passage from the article which documents it. The fact of the matter is that there is a self-replicating molecule. The self-replicating molecule is called RNA, and one of the main barriers on the road to believing that living things could have evolved from non-living matter is crossed. It's a fact. It's there. The experiments were done. There is a self-replicating molecule. It's called RNA. Now, does that prove that life evolved from inanimate matter? Absolutely not. There's only one thing that could do that, and that is if something came slithering out of Stanley Miller's flask. Now, I want to point something out here. Nothing comes slithering out of the flask, by the way. We don't prove things in science, we disprove them. Almost every step of this process has been tested in some way, and at no step has it been possible to disprove the suggestion that life could have evolved from non-living matter. Now, can we exclude the possibility, as Darwin suggested, that the first cell was made by the Creator? No, absolutely not. But can we say, as I think Dr. Morris may, that such a thing is impossible, even giving the whole Earth as a laboratory and 500 million years? No, absolutely not. In our labs today, we can see that every step of the process happens. Some of them happen slow, and some of them happen fast. Now, I want to ask you a question. Do you think that the possibility of such an origin in the prebiotic dust demeans human life? I don't think it does. And I'm reminded of a quote from the Bible that I learned as a little boy. Remember, man, thou art dust, and to dust thou shalt return. I don't think even Stanley Miller could have said that better. Now, one of the central arguments of the special creationists is about the fossil record. There are gaps in the fossil record. Dr. Morris says the gaps are real. They're fatal to evolutionary theory, and they're predicted by special creation. There you go. Let me lay it right down in front of you. The gaps are real. Evolutionists agree with Dr. Morris. You know that because he's been quoting them. They're saying the gaps are real. But let me show you what those gaps mean. Next slide. I tried to find a slide of the most dramatic gap that exists in the fossil record. I think Dr. Morris would agree with me. There's almost nothing that's as dramatic as this. It's the appearance of the angiosperms about 150 million years ago in the evolution of plants. Now, an angiosperm is just about any plant you see out there. Trees are angiosperms. Everything you grow in the garden, your lawn, everything. The only big plants that are around today that aren't angiosperms are evergreens and firs. Everything in the world is an angiosperm. They're all over the place. Prior to 150 million years ago, there wasn't one on the Earth. There's nothing in the fossil record. The angiosperms appear suddenly at 150 million years, and all of a sudden they're all over the place. It's almost as if a creator looked around and said, boy, I am bored with ferns. Let there be angiosperms. And they appear exactly as Dr. Morris said special creation would predict them. No question, no argument there. They appear suddenly without ancestors, without transitional forms. We have zero idea of where they came from. There's even a quote from a botanist, and I've got it if he needs to borrow it, and the botanist says, the fossil record of higher plants is in favor of special creation, exactly as if the Creator come along. Now, you might get the impression that the sudden appearance of something, the big gap in the fossil record, is a supporting idea for special creation. Get ready for a surprise. It's not supporting for special creation. Dr. Morris doesn't say that angiosperms appeared suddenly. He says they were always there. He says angiosperms were present from the beginning of life on Earth because all plants and animals were created at the same time. In other words, they don't appear up there at the top. They're all the way down to the bottom. Special creation, which says that all forms of life were created in one verse, says angiosperms have always existed. Incredible. Nothing could contradict the fossil record more. than to say that angiosperms have always existed. I just can't believe it. Next slide. This is an idealized slide of the kinds of gaps. It doesn't show anything. I just drew these to show you what evolutionary charts are always like, of the kinds of gaps that existed. And every dotted line there is a gap. And every question mark is a, where did it come from? Or where did it go? And there's lots and lots of them in evolutionary theory. You want to be an evolutionary biologist? Don't worry. There's lots of things left to figure out. Okay. The point is this, that this is exactly what evolution looks like. There's lots of gaps. We don't have smooth transitions. Is this what is predicted by slow and gradual evolution? Evolution has a problem. Evolution says we should have something in the dotted lines. That's a difficulty for one kind of evolutionary theory called neo-Darwinian. It's attempted to be explained by the punctuated equilibrium model, but even that has some problems. That's the hopeful monster model, in case you're trying to grope for the words. However, how does this fossil record compare with Dr. Morris's prediction about living things? Next slide. He says everything was there at the beginning. Everything was created side by side. We got trilobites, we have extinct ferns, we have dinosaurs, we have dogs and cats, we have people, everybody's down there at the bottom. There's this great catastrophe, that's the dotted line. Lots of things get wiped out, we form all the fossils, and then everything moves unchanged up to the present. From this prediction, we should find the greatest diversity in the oldest rocks. That is upside down from the fossil record. We find the greatest diversity at the top. It's unbelievable. This is the problem. Now, how does Dr. Morris deal with the problem? Now, you may have guessed it. He says that all the fossils in the world were formed in one shot, in one great catastrophic flood. It's unreal. The fact that living forms differ at different levels in the fossil record, well, Dr. Morris said that's no problem. The really stupid things didn't even know it was raining, so they got stuck down in the Precambrian rock. The relatively intelligent animals, they started to move for higher ground, but they were slow and they were overwhelmed. The moderately smart things like primitive mammals got the rest of the way up. The intelligent things like modern mammals are near the surface, and that clever but sinful creature man, he is found only at the very top of the fossil record because he got to the peaks of the mountains and climbed the trees and so forth and so on. And that accounts for the stratification that we see of the fossil record among living things. Now, my dear friends, the geologists of the 18th century and the 19th century were just as convinced that all these things happened, just like Dr. Morris said. But when they dug down into the ground, they found the fossil record didn't support that interpretation. They realized that these things were, in fact, the records of many ages. Now, I want to point out that flood geology, which is what this is called, could have been rescued when radiometric dating came along. Because, you see, if Dr. Morris was right, those radiometric dates would have given the same ages for every single thing in the fossil record. It could have been the greatest support that special creation had ever seen. And what happened? Exactly the opposite. What does special creation have to do with the fossil record? It has to say the fossil record is upside down. Next slide. Okay, here is a standard diagram of the evolution of the vertebrates. And these are the famous gaps that Dr. Morris talks about. Now, again and again, a special creationist must deny that transitional forms could ever have existed because they believe that no kinds can change. But we have several examples, not just of intermediates, but of slow and gradual changes between major groups. The most dramatic one, because it's the most recent and therefore the most preserved, is the transition from reptiles to mammals. Now, in fossils, scales and hairs, we got hairs, they got scales, are generally not preserved, so we can't study these things as we change. But there are very dramatic differences between reptiles and mammals associated with the skull. Next slide. And those are best seen in the bones of the lower jaw. A modern mammal, as seen in the top, has a single jawbone. It's called the dentary. And it has three bones in the middle ear, the stapes, the incus, and the malleus, or the hammer, anvil, and stirrup, as they're usually popularized. A reptile, and this is an extinct one called Prolacerta, has four bones in the jaw. That's very critical. And only one bone, the stapes, in the middle ear. The quadrate at the end of the jaw is the equivalent of the incus and the articular, the malleus, the ones that eventually wind up in the inner ear. Now, what happened to the fossil reptile over 120 million years? Next slide. Now, I apologize for how finely graded the slide is. I wanted to fit a lot of things on one, and I've got a better one that will come up in a second. Now, there are eight steps here. I want to say right up front, because I know Dr. Morris knows the literature, and he'll catch me if I don't, that the one on the bottom and the one third up from the bottom are imaginary. They never existed, and the artist drew them in to show how continuous the series might have been. And that would have been a real problem if they were the critical steps of the transition, but they're not. The critical steps are near the top. Now, notice as you go from the bottom, which is the oldest, to the top, which is more recent, and each of these are the inside and the outside views of the jawbone, that the dentary, that big bone, as you go up, gets larger and larger and larger, slowly and gradually, until in stages 11 and 12, those two little bones are pushed all the way to the back of the jaw. And then in stage 10, those bones are detached, and they wind up in the inner ear. The transition is slow and gradual. A true mammal is formed from a true reptile. There are no missing intermediate forms. This is a higher magnification view of the same thing. The last reptile, if you want to call that, is the next to the top, where those two bones have gone all the way to the back and they're really small. And the tympanic membrane, which goes in the inner ear, is stuck on the jawbone right on them. And in the next slide, they become detached. Now, is there anything in this series that causes a problem for evolutionary biologists? Next slide. There certainly is. And this is exemplified in this quote by Neville George. The problem is that the transition is so slow, so gradual, so graded, we don't know what to call a reptile and a mammal. As George points out, the distinction is almost arbitrary. Is that consistent? Is the statement that you can't tell where reptile ends and mammal leaves off consistent with the broad generalization that we never see a transition between one kind and another? Of course not. Now, creationists have a lot of fun with this distinction because they say at the critical step where those two bones come off, next slide, and I'll show you what the problem is, those two bones form the attachment of the upper and lower jaws. They form the joint of the jaw. So the special creationists may say, well, you know, when those bones come off, that animal can't eat because its jaw just got unhinged, and the bones are still migrating up to the ear, so it can't hear either. So this thing couldn't hear and it couldn't eat. Okay, that's a perfectly valid objection. It turns out that there's a transitional form which shows precisely how this works. Next slide. It's called eosostrodon. Eosostrodon simply means the first mammal-like form. And what it has is a double jaw joint, and you can see it very clearly in the bottom. A reptilian jaw joint, which is where the hinge occurs, forms alongside the mammalian one. So it has a double jointed jaw. Now, I have seen this skull. It's up at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard. I've touched it with my hands, and I've moved the hinge. And the jaw joint is indeed a double one. And the answer is that when those bones become detached, the animal can both eat and hear. It's a perfect intermediate form, and so is everything else in that sequence. I want you to look very carefully at what I've talked about. And I want to ask you, is all of this consistent with the statement that transitional forms never existed? Or is Dr. Morris merely determined not to see what's there? Okay, next slide. Now, if this was only one instance of transitional forms, just one, this would be fatal to creationism. Is that the only one we got? There's a lot. These are some of the slides in the horse series that Dr. Morris has already mentioned. These are called Hyracotherium, that's the little guy in Hypohippus. Next slide. When the horse evolved, there are indeed gradual sequences, if you like gradualism, but the special creationists can look at these things, can look at the transitions. Could you get that in a little bit better focus? I know it's tough back there. Good, thank you. And can look at them and say that there are unimaginable gaps as the two outside toes get shorter and shorter and shorter until finally the foot of the modern horse is formed. It's unbelievable. There's no transitional forms. The steps are abrupt. And there's a quote from one of the biologists who has studied this saying, we've got no transitional forms. The decisive steps are abrupt. Okay, that's fine. I can understand that. Next slide. Now, we know, in fact, the evolution is not simple. It's branching. Now, there are three ways to explain the data. Evolution, to me, is the most direct, that one kind evolved to another, and the evolution was rapid, or we don't have it, or we just haven't dug up the fossils yet. Another is progressive creation, and that is the creator made a little horse, he got a little boy with it, made a bigger one, didn't like that after a while, bang, made a bigger one, didn't like that, made a bigger one. I don't mean to ridicule that idea, because that is not Dr. Morris's idea. He doesn't agree with that kind of creator, neither do I. It sort of makes the creator look like a bumbling idiot. He can't make the horse right the first time, so he's got to keep trying. Dr. Morris doesn't agree with that, doesn't believe it, neither do I. However, the next slide shows what Dr. Morris does believe, and that is that when we look in the stratum and we see a sequence of horses, or the reptilian to mammalian sequence, or anything else, and we see this going up, we're seeing not a gradual transition, not evolution, not progressive creation either, but what we're seeing is where five or six different kinds of animals were stratified in a great flood. In other words, he thinks this results from a distinction between these animals in their ability to tread water, and therefore they wind up at different levels in the stratification during the flood. There are no variations in this. This transition is clean. It goes in one direction, but nonetheless, it's an illusion created by the flood. They're all present at the same time. The flood lays them out that way. Okay, next slide. Is that all we got? We just got horses and reptiles and mammals? No. We have a very good documented history for the evolution of the elephant. There are three kinds that you'll recognize. Right at the top is the mastodon. It's extinct. On the left-hand side, is Loxodonta. That's the African elephant. On the right-hand side is Elephas. That's the Asian elephant. And we have a marvelous series of transitions that fully document how they changed from individual ancestors. The tree branches. Evolutionary trees always seem to branch, but the record is clear. There's no gaps. There are lots of transitions. Next slide. This is the evolution of a kind of organism called the nautiloid. We have a marvelous series of transitional forms for how the shell changed, slowly and gradually, the way Dr. Morris says, has never happened in living history. And the next slide shows that we even have transitional forms in extinct animals. This is Titanotherus. He's an extinct animal who roamed the plains of North America 50 or 100 million years ago. I'm so glad he is extinct, but what we have is a nice series of graded forms in which the horns and the size of the head change slowly and gradually. There's more, there's more, there's more. And to crown the case perfectly, I won't have time to present it now, but there are even transitional forms leading to our own species. I want to talk, finally, about the ultimate test of evolution. Something that Darwin could never have anticipated and could have blown the lid off evolutionary theory, wiped it right out. It's called molecular biology. Now, in recent years, it has become possible to compare the amino acid sequences of similar proteins in different species. And this development could have been fatal for evolutionary theory. See, evolution would predict that organisms which evolved in a certain sequence of divergence should show amino acid differences in their proteins related to when two species diverged or split apart during evolution. Creation, on the other hand, would predict something different. The creator made each kind separately, so these proteins might either be all the same in all species, and that would disprove evolution, or they might vary in a way that had nothing to do with this imaginary evolutionary tree, and that would disprove evolution too. Now, one of the best ways to test this is to look at a protein that all living things have. Next slide. It's called cytochrome C. Oh, sorry. Skip it. I'll tell you about that later if you want to. Skip that, please. Okay. Cytochrome C is a respiratory protein. We need it to breathe. I hope you're getting this down because I'm going to have a quiz when this is done. I hope you have all this information memorized. These are the comparative sequences of cytochrome C, and it performs the same function in us as it does in yeast and so forth. And we've compared the amino acid sequences here of a whole variety of different species. And from the differences, the next slide, you can construct a nice little roadmap. And this is the sort of thing that tells you how far it is from Kankakee to Dubuque and so forth and so on, except this tells us how many amino acids there are between us and, you know, ferns and us and monkeys and so forth and so on. How distant are we in terms of cytochrome C from the chimpanzee? Now, I mean, Dr. Morris says, we're not related to the chimpanzee. We're separately created kinds. We have no common ancestry. There is one, count them, one amino acid substitution between us and the chimpanzee and between us and the gorilla. Okay, you can take this and you can forget evolution. In fact, the first guys who did this didn't know anything about evolution. And you can then construct a tree based on when the proteins in this species might have diverged, in each species might have diverged, based on the amino acid sequences, the internal molecular details of a protein. Next slide. Lo and behold, the damn thing matches the evolutionary tree. Next slide shows the same thing in more detail. Now, there are discrepancies with the evolutionary tree. Some things are far apart here, and it seems from evolution they should be closer together. But in no case is there a contradiction to any relationship. In other words, in no case does it say that we're actually closer to the yeast than we are to the cat or something like that. In fact, it is remarkably the same. Now, maybe I pick cytochrome C because it's a cheap shot. It's an isolated example, and it's the only one it happens in. Next slide. Here are three different proteins plotted as a function of amino acid differences versus what evolutionists tell us about when the species diverged. Cytochrome C shows a smooth line, which means the older we think it diverged, the more different the amino acid sequences are. Now, there are some proteins that change or evolve slowly and some that evolve rapidly. The histones evolve extremely slowly. You know why that is? Because histones are used to fold DNA in the chromosome. If there's a slight alteration in that, the animal's probably going to die. So a mutation in that is very, very rare. Other proteins evolve more rapidly, but in no case, in no studied protein, has there ever been a contradiction to a single critical aspect of the phylogenetic tree. And the next slide shows the average sort of things for about 10 proteins picked out of known amino acid sequences, and the result is perfect. Now, all of this is a dazzling confirmation of evolutionary theory. How does special creation, or how can special creation, salvage itself from this? Only by assuming that the creator would know how we would construct this absurd theory of evolution and then make the molecular details in his creation match it so it would fool us. It's the only thing I can think of. Okay, in summation, what have we got? We have a so-called scientific theory called special creation, which Dr. Morris says fits the facts perfectly. How does it fit the facts? Number one, it ignores the age of the universe. Number two, it ignores radiometric dates from rocks. Number three, you get right down to it, it ignores the fossil record, gaps and all, and says the fossil record is a great illusion, which fools us into believing the Earth has changed. It quotes extensively from critiques from scientists criticizing mechanisms and theories of evolution, and misplaces the criticism to pretend that what they're really saying is that evolution never happened. It maintains that there are no transitional forms. Friends, there are lots of transitional forms. It says that there's nothing intermediate between man and any other species. When I get the chance to speak again, I'll show you that there are lots of intermediates between us and other species. It says that the remarkably consistent details of molecular evolution are just an accident or just an act of a creator trying to fool us. And lastly, it says, as Dr. Morris did when he opened, that evolutionary theory is a historical process in the past. It exists on faith and it cannot be disproven. Now I want to close by taking the last point. The contention that because evolution relates to origins, it cannot be disproven is simple nonsense. It stems from criticisms from various scientists of evolutionary theory as being too vague. But could evolution be disproven? Of course it could be disproven. Evolution as a historical occurrence could be disproven if we could see that the size of the observable universe was 10,000 light years or less. Blow it right out of the park. It could be disproven if radiometric dating, when it was invented, suddenly told us the Earth was only 10,000 years old. And it certainly could have told us that. It could be disproven if simple molecules could never become converted to complex ones in experiments like those of Stanley Miller. It could be irrefutably and overwhelmingly disproven if when we dug into the ground, we found that life at every level was the same as it is today. If we found human skeletons and puppy dogs and maple trees all the way back to Precambrian rock. And it could be disproven if we found that the relationship of molecular biology or the relationships that molecular biology tells us were entirely at variance with each other and with evolutionary pathways. If no process of evolution had taken place, any one of these things could have disproven the idea of evolution. But instead, at every case, it's the idea of special creation which is falsified again and again and again. Now, one must look very closely at the ideas of Dr. Morris and beg him to show us the scientific evidence that supports those ideas. And failing that test, we must deal with special creation in the same way that Copernicus dealt with the notion that the sun orbits the Earth, and that is by choosing instead the model of simplicity and truth. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll certainly have to acknowledge that Dr. Miller is a very worthy opponent. He covered a great deal of material and did it very well. It's going to be certainly difficult for me to answer it in the 20 minutes. I would say that there are answers, however, and I would commend to you some of the literature and further study if you'd like to care a little further. I am sorry that somehow I didn't come through that I was giving positive evidence for creation. We suggested that I was only arguing against evolution. What I tried to do, and let me just reiterate, was to show the predictions from the creation model, having defined it, and then to show that the actual facts conform to the predictions. For example, the creation model predicts the two laws of thermodynamics as universal principles, and then that's what we find. The evolution model does not predict those. In fact, it would be very difficult to explain those in the framework of the evolution model, but it certainly doesn't predict them. Creation model does. Creation model predicts the gaps in the fossil record. And that's exactly what we find. Evolution model does not predict the gaps in the fossil record. It maybe can explain them, but it doesn't predict them. And so on. The actual data conform precisely to the expectations of the creation model. Also, if you recall, just at the end, although I didn't have time really to develop it fully, tried to show that the prediction related to catastrophism was fulfill in the actual facts of the records in the rocks. In other words, the rock systems, the fossil graveyards, the hydraulic characteristics of the rocks, all of these speak of catastrophism throughout the entire record. And furthermore, they conform to the concept of one catastrophe, the entire geological column indicating continuous deposition, catastrophic deposition. And therefore, relating necessarily all to one age. The fossil record, instead of representing the slow evolution of life over many, many billions of years, many ages, represents the extinction of life, the destruction of life in one age, because the evidence indicates catastrophic deposition throughout the geological column, furthermore, continuous deposition throughout the geological column. As far as the order of the fossils is concerned, the prediction of the hydraulic cataclysm model, if you wish to call it that, flood geology, as some have called it, would be this. If, for example, a worldwide flood were to strike the world today and then stir up things and carry them and deposit them, you would expect to find the formations, the deposits, in somewhat similar fashion to what is actually found. That is, in any one locality, you'd expect to find the simpler organisms, so to speak, on the lower levels, the more complex organisms at the upper levels, because that's the order of elevation of their habitat. Now, you do not find the geological column as a whole anywhere. The geological column in its standard form represents something like 100 miles to 200 miles in thickness, depending on the writer that you happen to read. In any one locality, you'll find an average of 1 mile thickness of the sedimentary column. Some places nothing, some places maybe 15 miles or more, but the average about a mile. Nothing like the standard geological column anywhere. You find the standard geological column with the sequences in the so-called geological ages in one place only. That's in the textbook. You don't find it anywhere else in the real world. These different ages have to be brought together by superposition and various means, but the fact is the evidence of the phenomena, the physical phenomena of the rocks themselves indicate unit deposition, that is, unit at one, essentially one time, catastrophic formation of the entire system. Now, this would further predict, of course, that is, the catastrophic model would predict that there would be no way really of distinguishing between one age and another age, and we would not be surprised if we found, for example, the normal sequence from the simple on the bottom to the complex on the top, which is an order of ecological zonation, essentially, occasionally changed. And we do find occasional exceptions to it. For example, there are many places where formations which supposedly are very old, in terms of the geological column, are found vertically above those that are younger. Now, there are many places like that. We don't have the time to go into detail. The great Glacier National Park area is full of this. There's a great block out there that's been known as the Lewis Overthrust, which is about 6 miles thick in its original extent. As I recall the dimensions, I haven't looked this up recently, 40 miles wide and perhaps 200 miles long, or those may not be the exact dimensions, but at any rate, tremendous in extent. And it's easily possible to show that there is no way, mechanically, speaking in terms of the strength of materials and the fluid pressure required to float such a block, if that's the way it was done, is sufficient to account for that. To have a great block of Precambrian materials, say a billion years old, which once was down below the Cretaceous materials, say 100 million years old, just completely inverted. There are certain places at the interface where there's evidence of disturbance, other places at the interface where there's no evidence of disturbance. But of course you can have disturbances at interfaces without any such thing as an overthrust or an out-of-order formation. And the mechanics of the situation seem to suggest it's impossible. You have many other examples of that. For example, the great Appalachian range, this country, has been found within the past 2 or 3 years to be underlain by recent sediments. Now, the Appalachian rocks are supposedly Paleozoic, that is, very old. But underneath them, the coastal plains rocks, which are very young, are comprise a horizontal layer extending fully under the Appalachians. And there are many other examples. The Alps are in the upside condition like that. The Scottish Mountains. Many of the other great mountain ranges of the world are like that. Well, there may be the possibility that there are physical mechanisms that explain how they once were in the right order and now are out of order. But the fact is, there are many such places that are out of order, and there are many of them where there's no evidence at the interface that there is any, that there has been any great differential movement. In some cases, yes. Many cases, no. Furthermore, there are many places where there are fossils from different ages together. Now, you wouldn't expect normally to find, for example, human fossils with dinosaur fossils. As was maybe suggested a while ago, we ought to find human fossils throughout the entire geological column. No, because man doesn't live with fishes, man doesn't live with dinosaurs. If there was a great worldwide cataclysm that buried them all, normally the burial would consist primarily of ecological assemblages that live together. They tend to be buried together, and normally man doesn't live with the dinosaurs, or wouldn't. Doesn't live with crocodiles. You wouldn't expect to find man buried with crocodiles today, or With maybe some exceptions, of course, because in a catastrophic situation, there might be occasional exceptions where they, instead of being sorted hydrodynamically, which would be the normal situation, would be chaotically brought together from different directions and in some way brought together. And there are certain examples of anomalous fossils like that. One of the best examples, best known examples, of course, is the famous situation in Texas where you find human footprints and dinosaur footprints together in the Cretaceous limestones there. And I may have a slide just to show you that this does exist. Now, I know that these have been rejected by many evolutionists further on than that. Yeah, there are some footprints that were cut out of the limestones in the river of apparently a giant man track and dinosaurs. Now, of course, it was found later that some tracks had been carved. Many of the dinosaur tracks had been carved. A few of the human tracks had been carved. Possible these were, because when these were photographed, they'd already been cut out of the riverbed. However, they were subjected to cross-sectioning, to the close microscopic examination to see if you could find evidence of the actual depressions of the silt laminae and so forth, and these were found. There's good reason to think that these were genuine, but in case these are questioned, the next slide will show some that could not be questioned. These are crossing tracks, trails of human and dinosaur tracks that were freshly exposed by the bulldozer pushing out an overlying layer. Now, there are these trails there. They're dinosaur tracks. Nobody questions those. It's a dinosaur state park in Texas. There are also several human trails, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot. They look like human tracks. If they're not human tracks, at least they look like it. They're not carvings. They're freshly excavated. They're not solution phenomena. They're clearly, as one geologist told me when I asked him what he thought about them, he said, well, they look like tracks of a two-legged animal of some kind, but they says they couldn't be man because man didn't live with the dinosaur. I asked him what he thought they were. He said, well, he didn't know. His best guess was that there was some kind of a dinosaur with feet like human feet. But at any rate, they looked like human feet. There are several in the row. There are several trails of them. Some 20 or more human-like tracks have been found in the same strata, sometimes overlapping each other with the dinosaur tracks. Now, this is an exception, but there are other exceptions like this that indicate there is evidence that the different forms of life did live together and therefore not so out of a reason to think that they could have been buried together. Now the question, however, of the so-called absolute age, the radiometric dates, the age of the universe, the age of the Earth has been raised. Now it's true, of course, that stars are estimated to be billions of light years away. And it's true that the suggestion was made, and not only by me, but many other creationists, that the whole creation was created, fully functioning, right to begin with. From the point of view of the creation model, that's not something to sort of sneer at. It's very realistic because in the creation period, the processes were not the same processes that we have now. That's the very essence of the model. Creation postulates different sorts of processes during the creation period. But if you don't like that, there are other explanations than direct creation of the light energy. It would be just as easy for the creator to create light energy as light generators to generate light energy. If you believe in a creator at all, it's possible for him to do that. And there's no deception involved, because to have real creation where the creator speaks something into existence that wasn't there before, whatever it was, whether it was light energy or hydrogen gas or primeval stuff, whatever it was, if something is really created, then it was not there before, but now here it is, and it looked like it's been there before. So it necessarily has an appearance of some sort of an age. There's no way to have real creation without that, so there's no deception. That's the only way you can have creation. And then if there's other evidence as to the age, well, then that ought to take care of that particular problem. Matter of fact, we can't even be sure that these stars are billions of light years away. They're very sophisticated, esoteric sort of assumptions involved in calculating the distances. I don't find any fault with the distances, but you have to realize that it's not possible to actually measure the distance of a star that's more than, at the very most, 300 light years away by triangulation methods of measurement. The others have to be assumed by various indirect calculations, but I don't have any particular quarrel with that. I would suggest to you that you can explore the full concept of the various creationist possible explanations for the apparent great age of the stars. If you want to read a book by my colleague and astronomer, Dr. Harold Schlesser, called Age of the Cosmos, he's discussed that in some depth. Same way with the evidence from radiometric dating. Dr. Schlesser also has a little monograph that we published called Critique of Radiometric Dating. He's chairman of our astrogeophysics department at the Institute for Creation Research. also at the University of Texas in El Paso in the physics department there. Now, there are a number of assumptions involved in any kind of a geochronometer. All the real history we have goes back a few thousand years. The earliest dynasties of Egypt and so on, a few thousand years. Beyond that, have to use some kind of a physical process, make certain assumptions about it. With those assumptions, you can come out with an apparent age, but the true age can never be known without an observer there to check the assumptions. And of course, that's not possible. And the question is a very real question. How do you know which process to use? There are literally scores, hundreds of processes that could be used, because all processes involve changes with time, and therefore, at least in principle, could be used to measure time, if we just knew enough about them or could make enough assumptions about them. So why use only the three or four that give old ages, that have long half-lives, instead of the many processes that have more rapid rates and therefore will give younger ages, because they're based on the same assumptions. Next slide will just show kind of a general... Oh, I'm sorry, that's another slide of the dinosaur. That's a dinosaur pictograph in the Havasupai Canyon. Next slide, please. Circular reasoning and geologic dating. We don't have time to talk about that. Next one, please. This is any kind of a system. You can consider that rubidium strontium, if you wish, or uranium lead, or whatever, or a physical system. Any kind of a system in which there are two product or two components, very simple, only two, one parent, one daughter. Now, those are changing with time. Next slide shows much of the A component at time zero, much of the B component at time T, and the equations that can be, this is oversimplified, but you get the idea. Now, in order to do this, you can set up the equations for the mass change in each of the two components, A and B, have two simultaneous equations, solve for the time, and that's the equation at the bottom. Next slide shows the same equation at the top, but now in order to solve that equation, look at all the assumptions you have to make. And this is oversimplified. You have to assume that there's been a constant rate, for example. Now, there's no such thing in nature as a rate that cannot be changed, but that's not as important as the next assumption, which is a closed system. In other words, none of the uranium could be leached out, none of the lead brought in, none of the rubidium or the strontium could be assimilated. Strontium 87, for example, occurs abundantly in the Earth's crust, 10 times more than could possibly be derived by radioactive decay of rubidium. So you have to assume that there was, that it's been a closed system and none from outside has been assimilated in. And the final assumption, or the third assumption rather, the most important of all, is that the initial conditions are known. How much of the so-called daughter product was there when the system was first formed? There's no such thing in nature as an unchangeable rate or as a closed system. That's an ideal concept. Doesn't exist in the real world. Or no way we can know these initial boundary conditions because nobody was there, say, a billion years ago. Therefore, we cannot be sure. Now, it may be that if you have several different calculations from different systems, different rates, give you different ages, if they all agree and are accordant ratios, then you can have a certain amount of confidence in them, but you can never be, of course, sure. Most of them, of course, are discarded. Now, it was mentioned that the rubidium strontium method is probably the best, because there you can develop what's called an isochron diagram from different samples in different locations in the region, plot them up, and if they all fall on a straight line, that will indicate that the assumptions are valid, and there's no possibility of it having been an open system or something. But now, that's not necessarily so. Let me just read a couple of statements from two authors. One, this is in Science, 1976. One serious consequence of the mantle isochron model is that crystallization ages determined on basic igneous rocks by the rubidium strontium whole rock technique can be greater than the true age by many hundreds of millions of years. This is the problem of inherited age and is well documented in many instances of conflicts between the stratigraphic age and the rubidium strontium age in the literature. And in another article in Geological Society of America Bulletin, May 1978, these data suggest that great caution must be used when applying the rubidium strontium whole rock technique to metamorphic rocks. This and other studies show that metasedimentary rocks can yield linear arrays of points on isochron diagrams, but that the age can have a variety of geological meanings and need not define the date of deposition or the metamorphism of the sediment, and so on. Now, we don't have time really to discuss that in depth, but the idea is that if the rubidium and the strontium are together in the mantle and they flow together, they'll stay together. And this is true of the uranium lead and potassium argon too. For example, one of our Creation Research Society scientists several years ago compiled all the data on uranium lead measurements on rocks of known age, that is, rocks that had been formed in the historic period of volcanic eruptions. And these were known to have been formed within the past, say, 200 to maybe 1,000 years. And there were over 20 of them, most of them in Russian language journals, some of them in English language journals. But all of them had calculated the uranium lead age on these basaltic rocks or lava rocks of recent date. And all of them were found to be up in the hundreds of millions of years or billions of years of apparent age. Now the reason for the apparent discrepancy, of course, was that the uranium and the lead were together in the mantle. And these rocks flowed up through the Earth's crust and became an igneous rock. The uranium and the lead together were together right from the start, so that the apparent age might have been a billion years when it was brand new. But the important point is, you see, whatever the reason why the uranium and the lead got together in the mantle, that's another subject altogether. That has to do with nucleogenesis and the origin of the elements, creation of the Earth. It has nothing to do with the age. But up here, where supposedly this is going to give you an age, you do have, in every case, the apparent age tremendously greater than the true age. And now you recognize that all uranium, lead, rubidium, strontium, potassium, argon dates are made on igneous rocks, or metamorphic rocks, and these are formed the same way by the fall of the magma from the mantle, so probably all have the same problem. At any rate, we cannot be sure that they don't. So